I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air. It's another week. It's going to be a chatty one, I hope, right, Alex?
I think so. We've already been, because we have this moment, don't we, where we're like, okay, we need to press record. Okay, we need to press record. Otherwise, we just get carried away with starting the episode. Maybe that's an idea. Maybe we should have that as like an exclusive. You know, the first 15-minute conversation that we had that's currently not shared of the episode. Maybe that should be something that the inner circle, the our Platinum Elite members of On Air have access to, just to hear, because that first 15 minutes, especially if you and I haven't spoken since the previous week, I mean, that's full of, that's tea served hot with sugar and all sorts.
Yeah. It's I don't know how I feel about sharing that with the world, but we'll think about it, certainly. And it always is one of those things where you go, no, save this for the episode. No, save that for the episode.
True,
but we can't
true.
Stall. Yeah, guys, thank you for tuning in last week. We read your feedback. And yeah, what do we think, Alex?
I think, yeah, really helpful, because we want to know, obviously, what not only what works for you guys, but also what you feel you get the most out of. And there are just as many of you that said that you appreciate the level of the depth and the detail of the deep dives, but also the other side to that coin being that they that you guys also prefer in some scenarios the original format of the podcast, where we kind of are more conversational. We still have those deeper dives as part of the main segments and the newsy bits, usually in the middle of the episodes, followed by Q&A. So we are here to remain agile and to respond to the needs and requirements of our wonderful listeners. So we bear it all in mind, we take it all on board, and we will make sure there is a healthy mix of all going forward, right?
100%. Yeah. If we ever want to do, you know, a serious deep dive, we'll do that. But we're also going to mix and match so everyone is happy. But speaking of mixing and matching and being back to being chitty chatty, one thing we missed last week, which we didn't get to discuss, is the fact that if you guys have listened to On Air since the start, you will know that for the first, I don't know, several months, Alex's entire identity was spent 3 days in LA.
Right. Okay. So I didn't sign up for this, and I didn't know, and you're ambushing me on the podcast. That is a damn right lie. My personality was not the wonderful sunset city of LA and Beverly Hills, where I was residing for that period of time. There's so much more to my personality than that. So how dare you misrepresent me, especially to new listeners who might not have been blessed to have been hearing us from the beginning, from the earlier series of the podcast.
I just want to point out, speaking of that I was in LA on my round the world trip. I was actually there 3 times. So I have now put my flag there. I pulled yours out of the ground. I had avocado
I'm
toast.
I'm surprised
every
mine was still
day.
There.
Yeah, it was looking a bit ratty and tattered, but it was
raggedy
outside in and out. And I went to Erewhon in Beverly Hills, as you have to do, to try the Hailey Bieber smoothie.
Ridiculous. And you're laughing because you know it sounds pathetic. You went to Erewhon to go and find some celebrity smoothie. I mean, come on.
And I took a Waymo self-driving car to get there.
Okay, let's genuinely talk about that. So the Waymo self-driving cars, and then I want to talk to you about In-N-Out Burger in LA. But first on the self-driving cars, whose idea, have you done it before, and were you nervous?
What are you asking? Are you still asking about self-driving cars? No, I'm joking.
So, one of those episodes, is it? Goodness.
So we, yes, let me start from the very beginning. We land in LA, and the first thing we see as we leave the airport, because Waymos can't drive to the airport, but they're all over LA. So I'm like, oh my God, they have this here. It's the first time we've been in a city with self-driving cars everywhere since they were introduced. So I'm like, you know what? it's a cool idea, but I don't want to try it. I want to support real human beings. I don't want my money to go to some tech company. I want to support these drivers who are out here, hustling,
he says,
working hard.
Talking into his latest generation microphone, plugged into his latest Apple Mac, seriously, self-recording on his iPhone, connected to his eSIM somewhere. Yep. I mean, please.
I mean, you got to support people, like real humans, where you can, right? I can't just buy a laptop from the person next door. So anyway, we take our first Lyft ride, actually not an Uber, and the car shows up and it has no rear doors. So we have to enter through the front with this woman folding the seat up to let us get in. Then she drove like a maniac and the Lyft driver, and was talking the whole time about nonsense. We were so jet lagged. I was like, oh God. Later that day, we took a really long walk through Marina Del Rey down to the beach. We had the most amazing evening. Later that day, we need to take an Uber that time to get back to our hotel. And this time, the driver freaked us out a bit with his driving and what he was talking about. He was like going into politics that we didn't necessarily agree with. So the next day, we wake up and I'm like, you know what? I'm done supporting humans. I don't want to support these humans. Give me a robot.
Okay, see there was a build-up. This explains quite a bit. Okay,
exactly. And then we get in our first Waymo, and my life will never be the same, because you and I both know, we on the trips we've done together, we're both a bit nervous in the car.
Yeah, we're not the best passengers. You're right. No. Yeah, like I don't know. I think you're a bit better than me, but yeah. I don't. If the driver's going to go on their phone immediately, mm-hmm. I'm not happy. If they start erratically changing lanes for no reason, or just the lack of forward planning, right? You can see that everyone's slowing down ahead. Oh, but mashallah, you're continuing to speed up. No, you know, slow down. And also the excessive, you know, that awful style braking and acceleration that you get in the back of a Tesla, which is instant.
I can't deal with Teslas. I can't do it.
Instant motion sickness. Yeah, uh-huh. I can't. So yeah, we're not great passengers in that sense. The driver has to drive stably and smoothly.
And you don't want them talking about weird stuff. You don't want them smelling weird. You want the car to be good. God. All this stuff. So we get in this Waymo a little bit nervous, and within 5 minutes, we have unlimited legroom because the seats are all the way forward. We're blasting our favorite music on loud volume. We're talking loudly and we are having the time of our lives, because we realize that when there's not another human in there, you can do whatever you want. It feels like you're in your own car because there's no stranger there, but you also don't have to drive. So it's like the best of both worlds. And the car is super careful and cautious. At intersections, we never felt nervous or like it was making any risky moves, for example. But it also wasn't like too slow. It kept like where a light would turn yellow and it would immediately not try to make it, that kind of thing.
So it was the perfect balance. It would try to make it. It was like, a balance.
I mean, it's obviously calculating internally exactly how much time it has to do something. So it was just so nice. And the next time, so going back from Beverly Hills, we took another one. We step into the car and the seat immediately starts adjusting to our desire, to the legroom we used last time. The music that we were playing resumes immediately. Yeah. It was like, it's again like stepping into your own car. And we were sold. I was like, I want this everywhere. I want only roads with these cars, with no crazy drivers who are going to make irrational human choices, or people who are tired or drunk or whatever, you know. And it made me think that I've always been so opposed to self-flying planes, and this is obviously a controversial topic, but the same thing applies there, where pilots can be tired, tired. They're dealing with jet lag, weird departure times. There's most of the incidents that happen are due to human error. So what happens if you suddenly eliminate the human error? Obviously, there's the risk of external interference, which is more concerning for a plane than an individual car, for example. But I still see the benefits. And also, just for airport pickups, because taxi drivers, for Waymo can't go to LAX. There's like a red zone there, so you can't get dropped off or picked up in a Waymo. But what's the point in taxi drivers all around the world sitting and waiting for hours sometimes at airports to pick someone up? Isn't that the perfect place for a robot to be waiting instead? Because it's not really costing the robot the same amount for its time. True. It's just the lost productivity. You know, there's so many opportunities to make things more efficient and to use people's times more effectively. And this is an example of that.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Well, it was these style of self-driving cars, not necessarily only Waymo, but other companies as well, are making their way across cities, and they are changing the last mile, right? So they are changing how we reach our destination after the airline has finished its bits and pieces, and you've got your luggage and off you go. And also, a similar conversation I've been witnessing with some of the airline execs that I speak with are focus on how they can actually curate or change that last mile for something that doesn't look as predictable as just getting in a taxi, but is something that is more integrated into the air travel experience. You know, are we going to see an airline be bold enough to say like, hey, let's do a Hyperloop style thing with a big tech company where it means that you genuinely reach where you need to be rather than, or are we going to see kind of on a more basic level, more partnerships between, I don't know, a train company and the airline so that you genuinely get there? Is there going to be more black lane style transfers, maybe self-driving black lane style executive transfers built into a business and first class ticket by default? Airlines are increasingly having to think about that last mile, and self-driving cars is definitely going to be part, or is already now part of that conversation. And they're popping up. I've seen videos of them driving around London. They're at various cities now across the Gulf, in the Middle East, in trial phase, of course, dotted around Asia and so on. So it's an interesting one.
Well, think about this. Al Maktoum Airport in Dubai, I know, is discussing some groundbreaking luggage delivery systems, for example, where the luggage goes straight down into the ground from the aircraft and is then brought to the terminal by some conveyor or robot or whatever. And then you scan your boarding pass to have your bag delivered out of the ground. So there's no carousels. It's individual like that. So what if you take it a step further now with facial recognition and immigration? That's also a thing in the UAE, for example. It's starting to be a thing. Where imagine this, you get off your plane. Instead of going into the terminal, you get into a self-driving car. There's a camera in the car that scans your face. You clear immigration and it takes you right home. And then later on, there's a robotic car that delivers your bag, because it's also scanned your face and knows where you're going. Yeah. Like, there are many opportunities.
To rip up the rule book and just change how, you know, change the norms. And I hope that I think we will see more of it. Year after year, it's getting better, but it is still slow. I mean, when people are still struggling to find a bag, even with an AirTag in it, it's like, okay, we're not there yet.
It's a very slow industry to innovate, because it's so complex. So, we get that. Before we get into the news, there was just something I wanted to briefly talk about and hear your thoughts on. So I was watching a YouTube video yesterday where it wasn't related to aviation at all, but someone was talking about how nothing feels like an event anymore. So the Stranger Things finale, or something that should be so huge for people, it becomes hyped up for like a few days, and then everyone moves on so, so quickly because of how much information we're getting these days, how many things are happening, and also how spread out everyone's algorithms are. And it made me think of airlines, because this morning I was just like, oh my God, Riyadh Air, what's happening there? And I remembered that I was invited by a brand that's working on something with Riyadh Air. I didn't sign a contract, so I think I can talk about this. But I got an email saying, we'd love to sponsor your video from Riyadh Air's inaugural flight on February 1st. And I was like, okay. But now it's February 10th. There ain't been no inaugural flight. I'm like,
well, they don't have the aircraft yet.
Exactly. So, I mean, clearly there's delays and all this stuff, but it just made me realize that we were talking more about Riyadh Air in 2024 than we're doing in 2026, closer to their launch. And this is the problem with like all these airlines announce things these days so far in advance, and largely due to things outside of their control, they can't launch when they intend. But because people have such short attention spans these days, you need to, you can't announce things in advance anymore. It needs to be when it's happening, because people will move on and forget.
You're absolutely right. And for any airlines that need to hear that, you know, don't announce things too far in advance, not simply because, oh, people will forget, but especially in aviation, where it is up to all the other key parts of the ecosystem to deliver, and they can't because of the supply chain crisis, the lack of spare parts, the lack of manpower, the lack of skilled workforce, and so on. So you've got airlines unveiling cabin products that are not seeing the light of day several years later. You've got airline launches that are delaying the launch of their cabin products because they know that they're not ready. You're right. It's funny. And Riyadh Air, I mean, that was a lot of very early hype, which I understand, because they're able to very easily hype up something that is something to come in the future. And we've spoken in depth about that. What's funny is I still get this. This happened yesterday, and especially in the Middle East, right? Alex, how's aviation? Blah, blah, blah. And then, oh, and it's always the same conversation. Oh, Riyadh Air, huh? It's going to be something big. You know, I heard they're amazing. I'm like, how did you possibly hear that? Like, they are amazing when they haven't lost anyone's bag, you know?
Yeah, exactly. They haven't had a single delayed flight with a lot of people on it.
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny how generally the public prefer, in these scenarios, the devil they don't know rather than the devil that they do. And the grass is always perceived to be greener on the other side, even though at the moment there's not even soil for that grass to be kind of resting on.
It reminds me of your sister Demi when she asked you, Alex, why are we not on the new BA cabin when you guys flew?
Well, she asks that every time. That wasn't once. Every time we board a BA flight, she's like, oh, we're not on BA's proper cabins again. I'm like, what proper cabin? Well, the one that they showed at Farnborough. I'm like, Demi, let's talk about aviation. And then, of course, she asks a very valid question. Well, then why would they show something that they actually, in reality, don't have for most people? I'm like, oh, my God. The question
That's
that can't be asked
industry.
In air travel.
Yeah, that is all our grievances in one sentence.
Literally. So
It's partly the problem of showing something that you don't even widely have, but then there's the problem of showing something that you literally don't even have yet. And another example is Turkish new business class, which who knows when that's going to happen, but it's like, don't keep teasing us years in advance. Just people, even we, are busy enough to forget. Just build up hype when it's ready, and then people can enjoy it, you know?
Yeah, and people will, you know, if they and that's at least how it used to be years and years ago in aviation. But part of the reason there is because there wasn't the supply chain crisis that we have now, and all these suppliers were able to deliver. It's just all been such a mess since the pandemic. It's just ruined production across the scale in aviation. And when an aircraft has about 3 million parts, you only need a few to be unavailable for that aircraft ultimately, you know, be unable to be delivered. And that's the situation that airlines find themselves in. Seat suppliers. I mean, yesterday I was talking with an airline, and they were understandably freaking out at the fact that, you know, that's got to go in before Chinese New Year, because Chinese New Year is such an interruption to the production flow and the timeline and the schedule. And from what I understand, it's later this year than usual. I always associate it with January, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I think it's February to March, to early March this year.
Yeah, but that's a this year thing. So Chinese New Year this year is 17th of February until the 3rd of March. Yeah. And that obviously has massive implications on all the factories closing and the lead times and production and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So Yeah. Oh, I am seeing it does move. I'm just looking at an example. In 2008, it was much earlier.
Okay.
2007. Oh, it was late 2007.
All right. Okay. Let's move on from Chinese New Year.
2006.
Great.
It was in January in 2006. I'm just saying.
Yeah. I want to talk about something that I absolutely despise. I don't like talking about safety things to freak people out, and especially not when it's something that is so avoidable and so close to home.
Mm.
But SAS, this thing that happened this past week was no good. Inte bra.
No. So your national airline, the independent Scandinavian Special Forces carrier SAS, yeah, had encountered something, as you said, really serious, very easily could have resulted in disaster. I have no idea how this could have happened, but in a nutshell, it occurred on the 5th of February last week, Thursday, after we had recorded, and it was flight SK2590, operating, or should have been operating, from Brussels to Copenhagen. That's only a 470-mile flight, and it uses the A320neo, which is an aircraft type that you and I attended the delivery of all those years ago when we were just kids in the freezing cold Stockholm. 135 on board.
True, SAS as well.
It was in Stockholm, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and we did the delivery. Actually, it was a quieter delivery event. It wasn't...
Well, we weren't on the delivery. We just saw the aircraft in Stockholm at their reveal event.
Okay, yes, yeah, so it was the delivery event, but not the delivery flight. I don't think they did an invitee delivery flight. We were with Heidi from Airbus. Love Heidi. Mm-hmm. So... anyway, back to the scenario that happened last week. It was supposed to do... the aircraft was running behind schedule, which is red flag number one. Keep this in the back of your head, because this makes sense, surely. While it was supposed to depart at 8:30 p.m., it ended up attempting to depart at 10 p.m., but as you'll soon learn, that didn't actually all go to plan. So the pilots were supposed to taxi out to runway 7 right... and instead, they turned earlier at one of the intersections of the taxiways, and they started accelerating and ultimately commencing their takeoff sequence prior to the roll, which is where they pitch the nose up to the sky and the aircraft begins to climb. So everything before that, ultimately the aircraft accelerating on a taxiway instead of on pilots, instead of on the runway, the pilots reaching 107 knots. That's only about 25 knots away from the A320neo's typical takeoff speed. So this was an aircraft, if you were sitting on it as a passenger, that was very much seconds away from takeoff, yet it wasn't on a runway. Mm-hmm. It was on a taxiway. And there are all sorts of reasons as to why this is so incredibly dangerous, not least because a taxiway is shorter than a runway, so they were quickly running out of space. Taxiways, in most scenarios, are nowhere near as architecturally or kind of suitable from a geometry point of view, because in a nutshell, they're not straight, right? So sometimes they get narrower or they curve and so on. And so for both pilots to have agreed, do we start our takeoff? Yes. And then they apply thrust and accelerate down the taxiway, which is a completely different set of lighting compared with a runway. It's different colors deliberately, a different sequence of lights. It's structured and it has a different layout. It's deliberately done to ensure that in the hours of darkness, there is a clear difference between the runway and the taxiway. This is scary stuff, especially as both pilots were seemingly unaware. How could they have been unaware?
Yeah. First of all, we should acknowledge that this was at night. So they were relying on lights partly. But as Alex said, the lights on a taxiway and a runway are completely different colors. I'm no pilot, but based on what I've read, the A320neo also announces with audio when you enter a runway, right? So
if they were actually
on the runway, it was supposed to say they were on the runway, but they definitely did not hear that on the taxiway, I would assume.
And if you just imagine kind of visually, you have two pilots, they're running behind schedule, they're both used to flying this aircraft, but they're lining up on a taxiway that has green centerline lights with blue lights on the edge versus a runway that has white centerline lights and white lights on the edge. Just visually, that is a very different scope for both of them to take in and for one not to... Now, it's been floated that perhaps because of the delayed schedule, maybe tiredness, they were both seeing something that wasn't there. So, you know, when it becomes kind of the mundane routine and they... Were they both seeing a runway in front of them despite, you know, fresh eyes perhaps being able to very quickly spot that this is not a runway, this is a taxiway. So that's kind of failure number one. It does raise questions about if the A320 did its job in terms of audibly announcing that it was either on a taxiway or that there was a mismatch or that, you know, or that it hadn't yet reached a runway. So that needs to be investigated for sure in terms of the runway awareness advisory system, mm-hmm. which is something that's built into the 320.
Yeah.
All kinds of errors here.
Yeah. I mean, there's not much we can say technically because we are not pilots, but there's two interesting discussions I think that this leads to. The first is, I think that both you and I, if we had been on board...
It was my first thought when I read this, is I was thinking, as a passenger, you and I would have known instantly, without fail, that we
were on a taxiway. So then my question is, realistically, what would we have done? I mean, I don't think I would have started shouting, you know? I don't think that moment I would have done it, but...
It wouldn't have
made a difference, really, because the pilots don't hear you, but...
It could have, because, I mean, my first thought was, if I was 100% sure, which I think we would have been, in order to become 110% sure, I would have opened flight radar in that 1 second, right? And if I would have seen that our aircraft is on a taxiway, and we're now starting to accelerate, I would have shouted.
I mean, it's like a 30-second thing from when they start.
There is enough time.
I mean, there is, but also for you to realize something is wrong, for you to verify something is wrong.
I know, but you know what we're like. I mean, we know exactly what's ahead, and flight radar is probably already open on our phones and our hands at that time. So,
but I would start second guessing. I'd be like, maybe the GPS is wrong on flight radar. Maybe
the map is out of date.
Exactly. I would start thinking that. So that's a really tricky situation. But I know that
it is.
It's like the time when I have told this before on the podcast, when I was on a Ryanair flight and the flaps started going down as they, you know, put the engines to take off.
As they accelerated.
So that was one of those times where I was like, do I say something? But that was long ago. I didn't. And again, it's like once you're at that point, when the engines are already spooling up, what are you supposed to do? It's really tricky. The other discussion is, of course, the whole extremely short connection time is a problem for a lot of reasons, but especially these evening flights where airlines have every incentive to push to get people to make their connections, because otherwise not only do they have to pay EU compensation, they'll have to pay hotels, they'll have to pay meals. It's a huge inconvenience. Yet airlines keep selling 30, 40, 50 minute connections. And a lot of the time, these evening flights are going to be delayed because they've racked up a whole day of delays.
Well, so, 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there. And
exactly.
Then before you know it.
So it is a bit, I always avoid, first of all, I want to say booking those, like any connection under an hour and a half these days, but especially in the evening, you want a buffer. But this also shows that the incentive for the airline is, of course, to get OA as fast as possible. And that's what was in these pilots' mind. Just get them to Copenhagen, because a lot of people on this flight are connecting. They might be close to timing out because it's their last flight of the day. There's all these things that are contrary to the safety of the flight.
You're right. And the feeling of kind of being rushed, I also think, is inappropriate when especially, I feel like this is pretty prevalent in European air travel, where especially low-cost airlines, where you're boarding and then they start coming on with the announcements that, you know, in order to make sure that we don't miss our slot, we need everyone to, and it's like, whoa, because I understand that in one sense, it's just to stop people from standing in the aisle and just staring, you know, staring vacant at the overhead locker. But on the other end, it's also, if there is that feeling of rush, that's where mistakes happen. And I don't want my crew to feel rushed, nor do I want the pilots to be rushing. But it does happen. I mean, there are curfews that airlines are very well aware they need to. And also, you know, pilots don't want to end up in the safety office after having to explain why they took so long to, for example, you know, get this aircraft, the turnaround or whatever, when the office believes that they could have done it within the time.
Yeah.
And then and that creates a culture of, you know, well, stop taking your time to be perfect and just get on with it. And that's a concern in aviation, because for an industry that is so highly regulated and protects the fact that we're the safest form of transport, we can't have these middle managers making it worse by saying, well, you could have actually done it 10 minutes faster. Well, maybe so, but the pilot wanted to be sure, you know, and that's that's systematically, definitely a concern in aviation that drives tiredness and exhaustion and so on.
I will say that although I never think about this from a safety perspective, I do usually end up avoiding flights like this because I know that the one they're likely to be flights that are returning to a hub with a lot of connecting passengers in the evening, because you know that one, it's likely to be running late. Two, there's going to be something messed up with the connection. Like, I'm always worried about those short evening connections. If I have a short connection, I'd rather have it in the morning because I know that the flight is more likely to be on time. So just like in general, evening flights are the riskiest from an on-time perspective. Apparently, they might also be riskier. Not risky because aviation is still incredibly safe, but riskier from a pilot or crew stress perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's the time pressure, and it's the pressure of OTP, the on-time performance for airlines, and also when you're handling connecting passengers, as you said. But I don't think that any takeaway from a listener should be that they should avoid an evening flight returning to a hub
because not for safety. Connect.
Yeah, but no, but also because airlines are different. So you can't apply that to the long haul carriers. You couldn't apply that to flying Etihad and Emirates, for example. It's
in Europe specifically.
Yeah, in Europe, I get it. Especially when you know that that they're going back to base late, and there is that element of rush. You're trying to avoid inevitable delays is what you're basically saying, right?
At the same time, a lot of airlines will purposefully hold the last flights of the day from their hub in order to help connecting passengers make it.
And but that then your bag might not make it. It's being held for a technical reason or anything else.
No.
It is because they know how many passengers. In fact, there are many flights that for even just in the middle of the day, you can have a flight that will be an hour and a half late because they know that they're waiting for 80 passengers to connect from, you know, X airline. And it makes sense, rather than having to re-protect, as is the industry term, 80 passengers onto other partner services. So it's a very ordinary thing.
I'm just sharing my philosophy of feeling better about flights that depart before lunch from an on-time perspective than flights that depart after lunch within Europe and the US, where things are very tight and hectic. You don't have long layovers where the aircraft sits on the ground, as is more common in Asia, the Middle East, etc.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Let's go to, I mean, something else happened at San Francisco. We won't go into too much detail on it, but an air traffic controller accidentally cleared two aircraft to take off on parallel runways, basically at the same time, pulling them once again dangerously close to each other after they'd commenced their takeoff roll. The aircraft started their takeoff roll exactly the same time on runways, as I said, that were parallel, and they had their same departure clearance, meaning that they were going to follow the same pattern. Obviously, that was not going to work. And after both aircraft were airborne, the air traffic controllers had obviously realized and gave the aircraft different headings, ultimately directions, in order to ensure that there was kind of increased separation. I just think, again, the US, you know, we're just seeing this every single week now at these big hubs. There is real strain there. And boy, do they need air traffic control reform. I just don't know if it's going to happen.
We need Waymo air traffic control.
Yeah, seriously, because for all that's going on in the US, air traffic control is absolutely broken with no clear fix in sight. There was a lot of conversation this time last year about air traffic control reforms after the awful, devastating accident at DCA, the mid-air collision with the helicopter. But that's all been quiet. Yeah, it's not, no, and you know, we know what this current administration have focused on, and it's like everything but something like safety reforms with
Greenland
air traffic control.
So. Is way more important than air traffic control, apparently.
Gosh, where do we even begin there? Greenland, poor Greenland.
Poor Greenland. And poor Denmark.
The irony of the capital of Greenland being Nuuk. I
know. Well, anyway, I guess the feel, you know, when I was flying around the US a lot the past few weeks, you just feel that the whole aviation industry is treated extremely casually. Getting on a flight is like getting on a bus. Aircraft have departure times that are like 9:21 and arrival at 10:53. Everything is like very in and out. Let's go. Squeeze in here. There's always also the thing in the US of our gate is occupied. That's always the case. Like gates are pre-assigned days in advance. And then there's a bunch of, it's like a bit of a Tetris, because then one aircraft has to push back and then you can hopefully slide in before that's started its engines and done everything, so you don't have to wait too long. It's all very like cramming a lot into very little, and it's treated very
just
casually.
Just making it work.
Which I feel... Again, you go to Asia and it's so much more formal and organized, and every aircraft is taking the same exact route to the runway, and they're lining up at the same, and there's the same separation, and there's, I mean, the whole parallel landing and takeoff thing is so much more common in the US as well, with where you'll have an airport like SFO that can have four active runways at the same time, two for landings and two for takeoffs, and it's all in parallel. It's a bit like, okay, this is a lot, but thankfully nothing happened. So
You're right. Let's move back to Europe. Lufthansa want to add real business class to some of their 320s. Are they listening to On Air?
If they do, I think they would take one listen and stop listening again if they've heard us talk about them. But apparently they are, because if you guys didn't know, Eurowings, a low-cost subsidiary of the or a member of the Lufthansa group, introduced real recliner seats on certain A320 aircraft that are being used primarily to or from Dubai, because these are 6-7 hour flights that are very uncomfortable in any type of intra-European seat. I cannot imagine the people sitting through those flights in an intra-European economy seat on a 7 hour red eye, which SAS will now also be doing on an A320neo starting next winter. So Lufthansa thought, let's see if we can get some additional revenue by introducing these bigger seats that are an upsell from the regular intra-European business class, which is just an economy seat with a blocked middle seat. So it's kind of like their version of a business plus on board these aircraft. And apparently it's done well, because now Carsten Spohr is saying they want to expand it to mainline Lufthansa, not even Lufthansa City Airline or any of the other fun subsidiaries.
Oh, wow.
But real Lufthansa.
I mean, there has always been scope, I think, in Europe for something that is a bit more in line with what the US carriers have offered for decades and decades and decades with just like a recliner. At the same time, it's funny how it also people just accept what's current, right? Which is just the empty middle seat. And just recently, I flew from Munich to Toulouse, and it was on a Lufthansa A319 that was older than me, which is, you know, great, right? And the overhead lockers were gray, and all the monuments were old, and it was absolutely filthy, shoddy, broken, everything inside, right? It was really, and it was noisy and horrible. Anyway, what's funny is that they do sell that business class seat for quite a premium, especially on routes where they know there is a flow of business, like Toulouse, where everyone's going to Airbus. And everyone in the business club was American, and they have like different airline tags on their luggage and Airbus, because most of them, as I said, are going to Toulouse for Airbus. The crew, you get the kind of vibe that you are you've accidentally sat down in their staff room. So the chatting and the endless chatting, not even acknowledging the passengers. Anyway, and then, you know, then they're like, do you want this food? No. Okay, doesn't matter. That's fine. And then they throw a couple of chocolates to you, and then you're fine. But it's just, I can't understand, you know, surely they realize that as premium travel continues to make airlines the most money, and 2025 financial results for airlines reflect one thing that is very clear, which is that airlines are losing money, but they are covering those losses with the gains on premium travel. In order to tap in further to business leisure, if they can at least promise you something that when you're sitting there, you don't feel like a complete idiot for spending the money on, then I think that will, you know, go down well. But at the same time, I didn't see anyone else visibly kind of, I don't want to say outraged, but thinking that, oh, this is subpar, or this isn't great, or maybe they were thinking it, but people just get on with it.
Yeah, I think it will be interesting to see how this does, because the context is that this will presumably be used on longer flights like Cairo, Tel Aviv, Amman, flights that are 5 or so hours. They all leave in the middle of the night from the Middle East because Lufthansa wants to get them to the US connection, so the times are not bad or not great. So hopefully they realize that there is demand for this, but I think this could be a whole deep dive, because it's a huge conversation topic. Why isn't Europe interested, or why is why would no one buy this? Because ultimately, I think we're just at a point where all the airlines are looking at each other and saying, okay, you're not going to introduce this. Great. We won't do it. And they all get away with it.
And they all agree with the status quo for Europe, and that's how it is. And that's fine.
But it's just what I find very weird is that Lufthansa, of all airlines, would be the one to start, because they seem the most happy with the status quo. But maybe it's a response to Air France, for example, flying now 777s with La Première to Tel Aviv. How can Lufthansa on an A321neo compete with a wide-body 777 with lie-flat seats in business for people connecting from the U.S.? In the past, Air France has also flown wide bodies quite on and off to Beirut. So
true.
I'm guessing this is what they're eyeing and saying, okay, we need to have something slightly better to win back passengers.
True. Yeah. Well, we'll see. And it's interesting also, of course, that now ITA Airways belongs to the Lufthansa group, and they have a great 321. Oh, this is a subject we won't go into it today so that we can give this some more time. Have you seen all of the crazy negative feedback about the A321 XLR?
You mean from American?
From the passengers who have flown on it on American Airlines. And now they've given the passengers of Iberia the kind of... They've given them the idea to also be vocal about it. And for me, it's everywhere.
Well, you know what's funny is I did a review of it, and it's already being edited as we speak. So my script is ready. Everything is ready for that video. And okay. My takeaway was quite positive, ironically. So
why was everyone trashing it? And it was, and people were, it's, you know, when you engage with a couple of tweets on X and then suddenly it realizes that you like that. So it's going to show you and serve it to you, you know, everywhere.
Yeah.
I've seen it everywhere. Everyone is complaining. Oh, they were right about this trash, blah, blah, blah. And then I've seen some Iberia passengers chime in. Then somebody emailed me about it. I was thinking, okay, I can feel some kind of coup building here about an aircraft that is a game changer for economics, but maybe the passengers don't love it.
Yeah, well, then the only thing to say is vote with your wallet. Choose another aircraft and show airlines you don't want it. But
in my opinion, or just vote in general, hey?
Exactly. I think the outroar about American is specifically that they have 20 business class seats with one lavatory, while other airlines flying this aircraft either have fewer seats in business or will have more lavatories. And people are also, I mean, it's a combination of the seat being a bit of a regression instead of an evolution, because people want reverse herringbone seats that face the window, not face the aisle.
Not away, the window behind you. It's a terrible idea.
Yeah, but this makes me excited to share my review, because I guess I didn't know I would be devil's advocate when I recorded it, but my narrative turns out to be a bit devil's advocate, I guess.
Oh, we will stay tuned for the video. And I think with that, it's a nice segue into Q&A.
Aiden asks us, what do we think about the long-term business prospects of Norse Atlantic Airways? What is the future?
I think they're doing okay. They're doing pretty well. They seem agile and they're being able to respond to where the business is. They're definitely not hanging around wherever is not working for them. And that is key. Don't try to force something that's not going to work, because that's where the other low-cost long-haul operators have gone bust. I know that they have a decent team. And I am, as I said, I'm quite sure that as long as they maintain their agility and don't get too locked into, you know, flying to from Gatwick to Orlando every day, even throughout winter, which is just, you know, not doable. As long as they don't get caught up into that and they stay as agile as they are, then I think that's fine. I do think there is still an element of risk when it comes to Norse and their potential to quickly suffer operational disruption if just one aircraft and then, God forbid, two aircraft go tech, which is very normal in aviation for aircraft to require ground time to be able to undergo maintenance. But that puts these smaller airlines, especially the low-cost long-haul operators, under immense strain. And then just, you know, a couple of delays can trigger 5 days, 6 days of disruption, and then you're on wet lease or they've had to cancel and so on.
Yes.
So in summer months, I would say it's a bit riskier. But on the whole, they are doing okay.
Yeah. I mean, let's remember that they've given, or not given, but they're leasing 4 aircraft to Indigo. So they only have 8 787s. And I find it fun that they're increasingly shifting away from these typical low-cost long-haul routes we've seen. London, New York, it's been done. They're serving that, but at first, it was very like everywhere to the US. Now, they're flying from a whole lot of places in Europe to Thailand. For example, Manchester to Bangkok, which hasn't had direct flights before. They're also going into South Africa, for example, by flying from London to Cape Town. I think those, it's smart to go into places that are very expensive to fly direct, or there is a lot of low-cost demand, like to Thailand. So it's fun to see them trying new things. I think we can discuss this topic more at length, Aiden, in a future episode.
We'll do a low-cost long-haul viability.
Exactly. Here we have just a message from Stefano saying, this morning he got the joy of the infamous A10 gate at Heathrow. I did not know if I had to smile or cry. Keep up the amazing job, guys.
You're welcome. That's friends at Terminal 5.
Yeah, glad to help you with that.
Yeah.
Let's see. Also, we've got so many messages welcoming us back, so we appreciate that, you guys.
Amazing.
Siddharth is asking us, What do we think about the beef between American Airlines and United in Chicago right now? It seems really Ooh. Entertaining, but I don't understand why it's happening, he says.
You are across this more than I am I in this am. Scenario. Please.
And what... So to keep a very long story short, both of these airlines have a huge presence in Chicago. They compete fiercely, but this is really their main Midwest hubs where they're flying a lot of people in from long haul to connect to the Midwest. But also it's a great stopover point from the East Coast to the West Coast and smaller places in the country. So United has been doing incredibly well over the past few years in Chicago. They're making a lot of money. They have more and more gates because in the U.S., there's all types of weird systems to how gates are assigned. But basically, United has kept winning more gates at Yes. Chicago, while American has struggled. They've allegedly been losing a lot of money in Chicago, according to United's CEO. So who knows what's true? But they've decided, you know what? This is an important hub for us. So American has said, we're going to step it up. We're putting in more frequencies. We're putting in more flights in an effort to get more gates back. And we want to give United a run for its money. We're not just going to let them take us here. The problem is that American has let themselves slip, become less premium, while United is going more premium. So United really views themselves as top dog. Ha, American, you can't touch us. We're going to win this. You have no clue what you're up against. But American, as the underdog, really all they can do is compete on price. So they're in a tougher position because they need to undercut United on price to win back that loyalty and show people flying with us is not that much worse than flying with United. So it's a race or a competition between one airline that is, at least in that context, more premium and one that is less premium but desperate to keep its position and not lose further ground in Chicago. So we can expect to see some price wars. We can expect to see a bunch of interesting advertising campaigns coming out there. I know when you drive into O'Hare, United has massive billboards saying, want to give us a try instead of American? Go to united.com/switch and we'll match your status. So they're employing quite funny, shady tactics. But as customers, I mean, for now, it's a win because availability of seats will go up, destinations will go up, and pricing should go down. In the long run, one airline probably has to win, so we will keep an eye on that.
And on that note, the best airline that champions the consumer stay ahead.
Exactly. We're always pro-consumer at the end of the day. On that note, guys, thank you for tuning in. It was a lot of fun being back with the chatty episode, I think. And it was great as always.
Lovely. We will see you next week, same time, same place. And you can drop us any messages, feedback, or questions for our Q&A segment via the Instagram at On Air with Dan and Alex. All one word. See you next week.
See you then. On Air. Bye-bye.
You know that goal you set at the start of the year? You can still do it, whether you're committed to a thru-hike with friends, lifting heavier, or simply walking more. It's not too late to stick with it and make your future self proud, especially with the all-in-one nutrition shake from Ka'Chava. Because quality nutrition shouldn't be complicated. Just 2 scoops of Ka'Chava's all-in-one nutrition shake, and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. So instead of adding to your back stock of supplements that overpromise and underdeliver, simplify your progress with just 2 scoops of the highest quality ingredients. Stick with your wellness goals. Go to Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS. KACHAVA.com, code NEWS.